Welcome to 3CR Radio.
Very happy to be here.
Vijay Prashad, how's your tour been with Redan so far?
Very interesting. This is my first time in Australia. I got to see a kangaroo. That was exciting. A kangaroo had a joey in her pouch. She didn't try to box us. She ran away. We also walked up to the federal parliament to watch the seagulls flying around. It was a miracle to see seagulls so far inland. You'll notice that I basically focused on nature. Mm-hmm. That was my presupposition of Australia before I came. But of course, met some remarkable people and learned a lot about the people's history of Australia. Just in like a week, I've learned a lot about people's struggles, you know, the Black Armada, the struggles to even build a little workers' solidarity park in Perth that basically, in one way, overlooks the world's most hideous corporations that are headquartered in Perth. So it's been a very instructive few days.
And how have you found people's reaction to you here? I mean, obviously, there was an attempted coup on your talks.
Well, there, people are welcome to say what they want about me, but I would hope that there would be some, you know, consistency and accuracy. Like, people were saying things to me that were news to me. That was interesting. I had to, in fact, Google several words to understand exactly what was being said. Look, frankly, I'm all for dialogue and discussion. If people are not interested in some formulations that people like myself have, that's fine. They are not being forced into them. Have a discussion. What was quite crazy was the statement, letter, whatever you call it, if you read it out, would have taken longer than the talks that I made. So, you know, people could have come and asked focused questions or whatever. Indeed, in New Zealand, where I was before, people did come and ask some of the questions that had been raised in that text. And I answered as best as I could. But to be honest with you, some of them were quite strange, you know. And I felt them also to be based on a kind of sense of the world that I don't really inhabit. Obviously, people see the world differently. You know, I've been, you know, within the Palestinian struggle since the 1980s, much before many of the people who wrote that text were born. You know, I've been with the BDS movement, Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement from 2004. I was on the framing committee for the academic and cultural boycott. So, you know, my bona fides don't have to be explained. I feel embarrassed even saying these things. And for people to say, well, he should be cancelled because we don't agree with everything he says, you know, frankly, I believe in a lot of things. But I'm certainly a very clear supporter of the Palestinian right to justice and determination of one kind or the other. So I didn't appreciate that part of my bona fides being challenged, frankly. Of all the things, that part of it I felt was slightly unethical, given the fact that we are all fighting against a genocide and that many forces are trying to delegitimize us while we are fighting to end this genocide.
And okay, so taking that as a jump-off point to address issues within movements globally of people being more focused on drama and than actual solidarity work or than actual intellectualism of any sort.
Yeah, I mean, what can one say? You know, I don't want to characterize anybody's politics as drama, you know, because I would like to believe that they are sincere, that they hold to certain positions and so on. That's what I would like to believe. On the other hand, I'm a person who believes that the politics of justice and progress, human progress, should be based in facts. And, you know, why do I so fervently believe in the cause of the Palestinians for justice? It's not a romantic belief. I believe that colonization is absolutely the opposite of justice. I believe that the decolonization struggle is one of the imperatives in our world today. When I was younger, I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement alongside the movement for justice for the Palestinians, because these were some of the decolonization struggles that had been incomplete. This is not an issue of drama versus reality. This is an issue of build your politics from the facts and have a sense of engagement with people with whom you basically agree but you might have some differences with them. I mean, the real question I would ask to anybody who was so perplexed, you know, by my presence in Australia is, am I your main problem?
It's the 80-20 thing for me, yeah? If we agree on 80% of all things, then the 20 is dialectics and we can work that shit out.
I suppose so. You're right. It's something like that. But also, it's a matter of perspective. You know, lots of people come to places like Australia and New Zealand. You know, they get funded by US institutions. They get grants from US foundations. I don't think I have missed it, but I'm not sure people have written long letters denouncing these professors for taking money from the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Open Society Foundation. You know, these are groups, including the Oppenheimer Foundation in South Africa. These are groups that have actively participated in genocidal activity against, you know, minority peoples at the mine mouth and so on. But taking money from them somehow is completely acceptable and gives you a free pass. So I really don't understand the sense of proportion or disproportion in this. Why is it that, you know, professors from Western universities are welcomed with open arms in Australia? Is it to do with Eurocentrism? Is it that when you are confronted with the journey of a person who doesn't have a university job but works as a journalist to earn his living and runs a research institute whose probably political line you don't like, is that open game? Isn't this a form of strangely Eurocentrism to not attack the European professor, but to attack the Indian who lives in Chile and comes on a tour for the first time to Australia, whom you've never met and probably never read?
What more of this critique of like a perfect, in scare quotes, left, where it comes from this like comfortability in being in an impotent marginality rather than becoming or working towards an active majority, an active solidarity majority internationally?
You know, it's an interesting thing because during this Israeli bombardment of the Palestinians in Gaza, West Bank, then the Lebanese and so on, during this period, 14 factions of the Palestinian struggle with very, very different political attitudes to the world, different social attitudes to the world. The gap between Hamas and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine could not be wider in terms of their social perspective of the world. Yet, these 14 groups came together in Beijing. They signed an accord. They agreed to work together and so on. They understand the importance at this moment of unity. If they, who are facing a genocidal bombardment, can put unity ahead of sectarianism, why can't the solidarity movement do the same? I'm not saying suspend all argumentation forever, but we are in the middle of a very difficult period when our friends are being killed. I've lost personal friends in Gaza. I've been to Gaza, traveled there, stayed in people's homes. Some of them have died. The 14 Palestinian factions didn't continue to persist with their infighting or their differences, their principal differences on political and social issues. They suspended it for the purpose of the unity in the struggle against Israeli genocide and apartheid. Why can't the solidarity movement emulate the unities put forward by the Palestinian factions?
And act in solidarity with them. I mean, Leila Khaled said, yeah, look, we couldn't be further away from Hamas, but right now we're under an existential threat.
Yeah, well, what's the difference right now between somebody from Hamas and somebody from the PFLP or Fatah or whatever? You know, when a bomb falls, it's not like some special bomb that only kills Hamas. It's been killing civilians, it kills everybody. You have to unite to fight against that. Your differences can be dealt with later. There will be time, if there is time, because it is something of an existential threat. I mean, look, frankly, in the international solidarity movement, I get that there are differences of opinion. People are frustrated, they are angry, they are feeling demoralized. They are perhaps even feeling like their work is not doing anything. There are all kinds of debates about tactics. Should we do direct action? Should we do mass mobilization? I get that people are frustrated. But frustration should never make people who believe in the same objective turn on each other. You know, that's not what you should do to your frustration. You know, you can't turn on each other. You are doing the work then basically of Israeli intelligence. Because you're turning on each other, you're breaking our unities, you're weakening us, you're making us less focused on the objective. You know, on tactical grounds, if somebody wants to do direct action, go and do it. Somebody else wants to build mass mobilization, go and do it. There's no need to fight on that basis. You know, what's the point of somebody who believes in direct action attacking somebody who believes mass mobilization? We need all fronts. I would like to see artists draw pictures, cartoons, poets write poetry. A mass cultural struggle against this genocide, that's necessary. Not sectarianism, you know, this is the correct way, the only way. Not just the correct way, the only way. That's a wrong attitude.
It's funny you say that, because that's what the Palestinian resistance faction as a united front have said. They've called for a unity on all fronts, is what they call it. An attack from all cultural aspects, all social aspects, any sectarian politics, and that's really a call to action to all of us. In saying that, how necessary is it right now to shape an understanding of imperialism and how it affects our day-to-day lives and have that shape our principles therein?
I mean, frankly, I think it's very important to have an accurate, fact-based understanding of imperialism today, because people are not always clear on what's happening. For instance, this debate has continued for decades. You know, does the United States direct Israel? Or is Israel directing the United States? In fact, this is an absolutely worthless debate, because the true thing is that the United States and Israel operate hand in glove. Doesn't matter who's calling the shots at which exact moment. They operate hand in glove. They are basically one country. You know, the other day there was a vote in the UN General Assembly on the blockade of Cuba, 187-2. I said after that, no, that's a wrong number. In fact, it's 187-1. Because Israel and the US is one. They always vote the same. So why give them, you know, lifting them up and saying they have two votes? Don't give them that space. Just say it's 187-1. Who's the one? United States of America plus Israel. Mm-hmm. They are one. They are not two. In that sense, we have to understand, what is imperialism? This is an imperialist attack on the Palestinians. It's the United States plus Israel. See, there are a lot of people who believe that there are multiple imperialisms, all this stuff. Okay, fine, show me. Tell me how. What is, for instance, the Russians have done that's imperialist? The Russians invaded Ukraine. But many countries invade other countries. You know, Rwanda invaded Mozambique. We don't consider Rwanda an imperialist country. These things happen. You know, Indonesia invaded West Papua. That's not imperialism. That's aggression. That's annexation of territory, but it's not imperialism. You know, Vietnam invaded Cambodia, not imperialism. They entered Cambodia to end the killing fields. Cuba, quote unquote, invaded Angola. In fact, they entered Angola to participate in a war to destroy the South African apartheid army. The entry of troops across border is not imperialism. It's an act of perhaps aggression, but it's not imperialism. That's a facile thing. Imperialism is a much more complicated system. The United States has 900 military bases around the world, 400 of them in the Pacific Ocean, several of them on the Australian landmass. It is ridiculous not to see the massive military imbalance between the United States and its close allies, including Israel, and large countries such as China, India, Indonesia, Russia, and so on. Those countries don't have that kind of military might. United States has the 5 to 11 eyes intelligence network. These countries don't have that. The United States has the G7, the coordinating body for economic and political policy among its closest allies. China doesn't have that. The Russians don't have that. The United States and the global north are a bloc. They are a military bloc, a military alliance, in fact, through NATO. The global south, the BRICS, these are not alliances. These are projects. BRICS is a project. Chinese do not have ambitions to go and take over the rest of the world. They are not interested in invading Australia, building military bases. They are not interested. That's not what they're doing. People say, well, you know, look how they treated Hong Kong. Excuse me. Hong Kong was stolen from China by the British in a colonial adventure, which China waited patiently for Hong Kong's lease to end so that it brings it back into the Chinese territory. You know, India didn't wait for the lease. There was no lease in Goa, Daman and Diu in Western India held by the Portuguese. The Indian army in the 1960s entered and seized it. You know, the Chinese have not seized Hong Kong. They have not seized Taiwan. You know, until the 1970s, Taiwan's government, based in Taipei, used to say there's one China, Taipei is the capital. After the 1970s, the United Nations recognized the People's Republic of China, and then they just said one China, Beijing is the capital. The Kuomintang has never said there's two Chinas. They also say there's one China. So I don't get how people in places like Australia say, well, Taiwan is an independent country. Even half the Taiwanese population that vote for the Kuomintang vote for a political force that says there's one China. Where the conflict lies is what's the capital. But these people aren't saying there's an independent Taiwan. So it's crazy, this idea that China wants to annex the world. It's not trying to annex the world, it's trying to establish its territory over places that it thinks are part of China.
And how much do you think that people that espouse thoughts of Russian imperialism or Chinese imperialism, in quotes, and put them against US imperialism, are they being naive, intellectually disingenuous, or part of a controlled opposition?
Well, firstly, it's a dangerous way to view the world. You know, let's take a stupid analogy. If there's a playground bully, and this playground bully is terrorizing everybody, and somebody shows up and says, well, that's one playground bully, but there are also two others who are, in fact, trying to defend some of the other people there. And you say, well, you know, let's live with the playground bullies because, you know, now there's a balance of playground bullies. And just normalize that situation. That's very troubling because then the rest of the kids are going to forever be terrorized by this playground bully. Why normalize the most dangerous military force in the world? You know, the Chinese did not go and destroy Iraq. The Chinese didn't destroy Afghanistan. The Chinese didn't go and destroy Libya. The Chinese haven't gone and bombed significant parts of Latin America or overthrown their government in coup d'etats. The Chinese didn't do any of this. The Russians didn't do any of this. I mean, the Russian war in Ukraine is nothing compared to the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. If the Russian war in Ukraine was comparable, there would be images all over the world, internet, TV, whatever, showing this ghastly bombardment of entire neighborhoods. I mean, it's not happening. They're not bombing Ukraine like the Israelis and the Americans are bombing Gaza. These are apples and oranges, or in fact, not even that. These are apples and stones. It's a completely different thing. One is a war, the other is a genocide. If I was to call what happened to Iraq with clarity, it was illegal invasion of Iraq, which became genocidal. I mean, 30,000 people were killed in Mosul when the US went and bombed it to send ISIS out of the city. 30,000 people. We've forgotten that. You know, maybe 2 million Iraqis died in that entire period. Forgotten. Almost every Iraqi that I know, because I was reporting the war, has somebody who died or has been injured.
When you hear reports from that era, especially from Iraqis, it sounds eerily familiar to what Palestinians are reporting on the ground now. Bombs, schools targeted, mass killings of people that are just civilian areas.
There's a big difference. Let's take the bombing of Mosul, which was toward the end of the US bombardment, real nasty bombardment of the country. Mosul is a city, but it's surrounded by a countryside. When the US started to bomb Mosul, lots of people fled into the fields. And they were therefore protected because nobody was bombing the fields. In Gaza, there's nowhere to run. So you are basically a sitting target. Even if you survive, you are traumatized for a very long time because you don't know when the bomb is going to fall. You know, we are sitting in a very nice apartment in Perth. You know, if a bomb falls and breaks that a section of the apartment building over there, there's no guarantee that 2 seconds later a bomb is not going to fall here. We can't even see the plane. We can't even hear it. There's so much noise. You know, we can't run. Like right now we're sitting in a veranda. We could jump over here, break our legs and crawl into the wood over there. But in Gaza, there's no place to run. You're stuck, man. You can't jump off a building. What will you crawl past? There's rubble everywhere. So the one difference is that people are sitting ducks in Gaza. In Iraq, they were not. They could actually flee into the countryside, to villages and so on. In Gaza, there is nowhere to flee. In Ukraine, people are fleeing. They're all going abroad. So many of them going to get jobs in Spain. Nobody wants to fight in the war. Their conscription has not worked really well. People don't want to fight in Ukraine anymore.
And how do we take a lesson from this in terms of Australia being now slowly over time positioned to almost affect a similar position towards China and Taiwan, where we will be the main buffer between an escalating tensions between America and China?
I mean, we are talking in Perth in Western Australia. Just south of us in Exmouth is a major communications and telecommunications base for submarines, but also they are planning for deep space. Just north of us, as you go up, there are submarine stations. Out maybe several hours to our west is Pine Gap, major radar installation, a part of the Five Eyes Triangle. Then you go north of there, Tyndall Air Base being expanded for B-52 and B-1 American nuclear bombers. Is this going to bring Australia safety? I mean, why do you want to put a target on your country? If the Americans decide to attack Beijing, if they put mid-range missiles in Taiwan and hit Beijing, you know, 8 minutes, 10 minutes flight time, the Chinese are going to hit Western Australia. And that means that you're going to go into a war with your closest ally. In terms of closest ally who? Not in terms of politics or military, but in terms of trade. That's your biggest trading partner. What's going to happen to the Australian economy? Do you think the Americans are going to win a war against China? The Americans can destroy a bunch of Chinese cities. That is their capability. But will they win a war against China? No way. And do you want a big missile to land somewhere in downtown Perth? No.
There'll be none left.
We don't want that. Nobody wants that. The Chinese don't want it. The Chinese don't want escalation. Why would Australia, makes no sense. Why would Australia want to antagonize its major trading partner? Why?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes this in lieu of a political class that is completely bereft of any morals or politics. There's no like neoliberal project or social democratic project. There's just this faceless lobbying of securing your private home in the beach, and that's about it.
What is that? I mean, you know, end of the day, yesterday, walking in parts of Perth, you see all these, the world's top number one and number two mineral and metals mining companies. BHP number one and Rio Tinto number two. They have a project. They have an agenda. They do 20-year planning. They know what's going on. They are not idiots. Yeah? It seems that they know what's going on, but the parliament, whether in Western Australia or in the federal parliament in Canberra, is not able to tell the people what its project is. These companies have a project. I mean, interestingly, one could only hope that these companies will see the unreason in some of these moves towards war. Like, will it benefit BHP and Rio Tinto for Australia to participate in a war with China? Is that going to be used? I don't think so. They're doing well as it is.
It struck me yesterday in your talk that you said Marxism is a process, is an action. It's an action thing. It's not a perfect formula. And that there's a legitimate critique to be within the revolution, within doing something better, not outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're committed to building something, you will learn new habits. You know, people who fight to build things build habits of patience as well, you know, and care and concern. People have different skills. How do you amalgamate people into a project and so on? It teaches you a lot to be involved. When you're not involved, and then you're basically sitting at a computer and firing off, you know, your insults at people, it's much easier to be impatient, you know. Patience is something that is learned. It's learned through struggle. And revolutionary patience is a very high ethic for people of the left.
And how much of this comes in this culture now of kind of co-opted identity politics, this thought of intersectionality and this sort of like, well, I'm of said affected marginalized category, yet I'm devoid of politics, and so therefore just by virtue of me being of that genocided place or affected place, then my voice is worth tenfold rather than my politics matching.
Well, firstly, oppression is real and people suffer oppression. But there has been a kind of unfortunate, you know, rebalancing of scales in the last 50 odd years. You know, exploitation is also a hideous form of human life, you know, where workers sell their labor to a boss, and then the boss basically eats the social wealth produced and gives a tiny amount back as wages. That's exploitation. Exploitation is a hideous form of social life. But over the last 50 years, we've elevated social oppression as a more hideous form of social life than exploitation, and talked about this binary between class and identity. Firstly, there is no binary, because most people who are workers have identities of different kinds. You know, there are black workers, there are women workers, there are workers with a range of identities, you know. And so it's not the case that class and identity are counterposed. But what has been counterposed is that oppression is seen as a much greater harm or injury than exploitation. And I think that is unfortunate, because that has then created a politics of recognition over a politics of transformation, that I would like to be recognized for who I am. It's important to recognize people for who they are. It's important to fight oppression. But I think this imbalance between oppression and exploitation has really hurt the movements of the left, because, you know, the centrality and importance of class struggle has been set aside. Now, again, I don't want to be interpreted as saying that class is more important than identity, because this falls into a trap we didn't set. We didn't say there's a dichotomy between class and... I think these are braided forms, that oppression and exploitation are braided forms. They can't be seen as a binary, where then oppression is much more harmful than exploitation. These are braided. One has to tackle both. But unfortunately now, the braid of exploitation has slipped away, and the braid of oppression remains in play. And people then put oppression ahead of exploitation, and then it becomes about who you are rather than where you are in a structure and what you're fighting to transform.